over in D.C. just trying to put a face to the issue like many people have, and seeing the opposition there, the kind of straight-faced, no concern, at least not showing any concern at that moment for the landowners and for the opposition over here in Oregon, was also just a huge challenge, and it was incredible to see her perseverance in that. What we've been doing lately is, you know, we are waiting for the FERC decision. We've been waiting to see what will happen with the EIS. So it's been a lot of organizing and staying strong and persistent and letting people know that there's all sorts of fights. So
on that note, we're out of time, so but let our listeners know what they can do to stand beside you in solidarity and you know, lend support to the incredible work that Cascadia Wildlands has done so far and is going to continue to do.
Great. Yeah, one thing that we're really calling for right now
we're out of time. We just need your website and how to get involved.
Oh, absolutely.
Sorry.
Go ahead and our website is caskwild.org, and you can find us on Facebook. And we'd be happy to hear from you and answer more questions on this topic.
Thanks a lot. Robin, you've been wonderful. Thank you so much. My guest has been Robin Meacher today. It's Manea Cascadia for Monday, March 14th, 2016. Kate Walsh engineered the show for us. Thanks, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Cable Community Radio and Friends of Clark County are proud to co-sponsor an evening of fun and food Saturday, March 19th at 6 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Vancouver, Washington. The evening will feature live music by Dan Weber, a dinner provided by Chef Sebastian Carosi, speakers talking about Clark County's smart growth plans, and local farmers on the current challenges and rewards of farming in Clark County. Again, that's an evening of fun and food, Saturday, March 19th at 6 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church, 4505 East 18th Street in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at cable.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. I need to tell you that you hear about new and interesting authors on KBOO nearly every day. Through the Powell's Partner Program, you can contribute to KBOO while shopping for the books you hear about over the air. We earn 7.5% on every dollar you spend at Powell's online. The same goes for books you sell to Powell's, which you can also do on their website. To use KBOO's Partner Program, go to kboo.fm/Powell's to look for books today.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. For years, activists and landowners in Southern Oregon have been trying to stop the Jordan Cove LNG facility. This past Friday, in a surprise move, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, that usually rubber stamps proposals like Jordan Cove, denied permits for the Pacific Connector Pipeline and the Jordan Cove Natural Gas Facility. FERC ruled that the pipeline is not in the public interest. Since the terminal cannot exist without the pipeline, FERC denied the terminal as well. This morning, we talked with Jody McCaffrey, Executive Director of Citizens Against LNG in North Bend, about this huge blow against LNG in Oregon and what it means for other proposed LNG projects that are still being planned in the Northwest. Jody, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I got an email on Friday from 350.org Portland with this headline, FERC has just denied Jordan Cove LNG. And it surprised me as much as it probably surprised a lot of other people. So immediately I started thinking about how to best respond to this. And the best person to have this response, I figured, was you, since you've been fighting this LNG terminal for many, many years. So I wanted to start by just giving a little bit of background for people who don't listen every week to Chris Andre and haven't heard you on all the reports that you've given from Southern Oregon about what's happening there. A little background about what this proposed LNG terminal was and why you were so much opposed to it.
Well, my interest is, of course, I live 2 miles from where they're proposing this. And when I started researching it back in 2004, when they were proposing actually an import terminal where they wanted to bring gas in, I found out that they were all these proposals down in California were being heavily fought by activists down there. And so they're trying to propose one here if they don't want it 14 miles offshore in California? So that led to a long research of this and lots of asking questions. In the beginning, I really did not know what LNG was, and once I found out and I made sure that my facts were correct, I started trying to educate the public here, because most of the people here, it's a rural area, were not at that time. In 2003 and 2004, we had just built a 12-inch gas pipeline to this area, so we weren't big gas users here. People didn't really understand the ramifications of some of this, and so that's been the whole fight. And then, of course, in
actually, before you go on, I just wanted, where exactly was this terminal being proposed, and where do you live?
I live in North Bend, and we have two towns here, North Bend and Coos Bay. They're in southern Oregon.
Right on the coast.
And this would be proposed on, actually across the bay, which is less than a mile from the city of North Bend, on the Coos Bay. And it would, the ships would have to transit a really narrow 7 miles along the bay, which goes along both these cities and unincorporated areas such as Charleston, before it could go out to the ocean through the jetties.
Now, originally this was going to be an import terminal, which meant that the natural gas was going to be coming from elsewhere, being offloaded in the port and then processed and then shipped by pipeline. Actually, it was going to arrive as liquid natural gas. Is that true? And then be
right.
Shipped as, it would be deliquified, turned back into gas. And they're going to build this extensive pipeline to get it to other parts of the country. And then what happened? Why did this suddenly plans change?
Well, at the time they were posing an import, they said we had to have this because we're running out of gas. We don't have any gas. And the gas from Canada, you know, is not going to be enough, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so it was obvious that the gas companies were saying, oh, no, we have all this 100-year supply of gas. And eventually, because of hydrofracking, they realized that we actually didn't need gas, that we had gas in our own country, that we didn't need to be importing it. And then they decided, well, we'll export. You know, we have this abundance of gas, and we'll export. So, you know, as soon as the import terminal went away, they had already applied for an application. I think it was in February of 2012 they applied for a pre-filing application for export terminal, and it was in April of 2012 that FERC they rescinded their order that they had issued for them to build an import terminal.
So,
of course, that order had been challenged and it had never been resolved. So they never really actually had that certificate 100%.
So the same infrastructure that they're proposing for the import terminal, the pipeline and all, would just be it would just be instead an export facility in the pipeline, instead of bringing gas from Coos Bay to the rest of the world or rest of the country, would instead be bringing the gas in from the Bakken fields or wherever they're coming from, and being processed in Coos Bay.
Yes, and the majority of this gas is coming from the Montney Basin, or is proposed to come from the Montney Basin in Canada. And even though Canada has all these proposals, they've had a hard time getting the pipeline through the area to the shore to export because of the First Nations tribal people have protested so much the pipeline.
So the area in Canada is inland, right? Is it like eastern British Columbia and Alberta in that area?
Yeah, it's around those areas. There's the Horn River Basin and Montney Basin, but they have to go over these mountain ranges to get it to the west coast to be able to export it. And they've already had worker camps built up there, and, you know, they've got quite a few proposals for LNG export terminals up there. But most of them have had problems because you can't build an export terminal if you don't have a pipeline that supplies the gas to your terminal. And if the pipeline's, you know, not able to be built, then you're kind of dead in the water.
So
I think what they thought is they could ship the gas down through existing lines and then build a new pipeline, you know, clear down here in southern Oregon, because, you know, they see Oregon as the weak link. Oregon doesn't have the environmental regulations at the state level that states like Washington and California have, that are equivalent to the National Environmental Policy Act. So it makes, you know, you don't have to, it makes it a little easier to get stuff through. Or so they thought.
Well, it was interesting to me because a few years ago, I mean, they were proposing similar LNG import, then miraculously turned into export terminals around Astoria on the north coast of Oregon, as well as the one down by your way. But the big one in Astoria was torpedoed after being initially approved by the city council. I think the city council was either the city council or maybe it was the class of county commission. Members were recalled, and there was like this big political flare-up and lots of opposition to it. And that project was terminated. There's now a new one that they're still trying to push through, which probably will also be terminated. But what's interesting to me was while Astoria was like rising up and very, very vociferously and opposing the LNG terminals and it being successful, it seemed like the Jordan Cove project just kept lumbering along. So what was the difference between what was going on your way and what was going on in Astoria?
Well, I think that we didn't get the press that the Astoria terminal had, because we were fighting this terminal down here just as heavily as they were fighting it up there. It's just that we didn't always get the press stories. In fact, it was frustrating to me because we would have these hearings and no press covered it at all.
Except Chris Andre was always there.
Yes, Chris, bless her. She was always there, always covering this. And she was one of the few that have covered it. But like I'm saying, like the local paper down here, you know, we have this hearing and it's kind of significant, and it didn't even get coverage in the local paper. So a lot of times the local people didn't know. I will say that, you know, Ted Sickinger at the Oregonian did come down here and did some coverage of landowner issues. And, you know, it got out there sporadically, but there's so many things that we have done. I mean, I think of all the testimony I've written. And nobody even knew, you know, and we actually appealed. We have several appeals still going on land use issues. They do not have their local land use, even though the their website says they do. They basically they don't have anything, really. The few land use permits that they do have are conditional, and they haven't met those conditions yet, so they really don't have those either. And there's still some really big land use cases that we haven't had the decisions come down yet, and we're in a contested case on the Southeast Power Plant. And that occurred, you know, once they switched to export, they had to have a power plant and a gas processing facility and add liquefaction trains to be able to liquefy the gas. So the project, like, more than doubled in size for land. And that meant that, you know, you had to have more permitting for those extra things, and that those don't have approvals yet. They don't have land use approvals yet, and they don't have state approvals yet. So, you know, there's still some stuff still out there in the works. The FERC, though, decision really should have been first, and this is why, because FERC could say no, and then you don't need to do all these other permit processes.
Well, this morning we're talking with Jody McCaffrey, who's with Citizens Against LNG in North Bend here on Locus Focus. Well, were you surprised Friday when that FERC ruling came down?
Yeah, well, I wasn't expecting it. It was a shocker. I figured they would go out of the way to justify the project. But when it came down to it, the project had such opposition. I think that's really what did it, is it had only 8% of the landowners had signed off, and the fact that the Pacific Connector and Jordan Cove do not have signed contracts. They do not have people that say, yeah, we'll take this gas. And that combination was just like FERC could not justify it. The public need did not outweigh the negative impact to all these landowners and businesses, including oyster growers and stuff that will be negatively impacted by the pipeline alone. So it's interesting, the order did not really get into the problems with the terminal, because the terminal has a lot of issues too with its siting. But, they couldn't even get past the pipeline issues. So that tells you how bad this project is.
Well, it was interesting when I was reading, there are two points in the FERC decision that were included in the PDX350.org email that I got on Friday. And the first point was that the pipeline was, there was more, basically much more harm potentially coming from the pipeline than any benefit. And so it couldn't be justified because there was no public benefit. And then the next point was, therefore, because the terminal can't function without the pipeline, the terminal is being denied too. So I found that interesting that the pipeline was really the basis for denying it. As I want to talk a little bit more about that whole dynamics of like why the pipeline is so bad, and then what connection does that have with why the terminal itself is so bad?
Well, yes, and I think that we always knew that if you stop one, you stop both of them, because the terminal cannot function without feed gas. It has to have feed gas, otherwise it's dead in the water. And the pipeline really can't function without the terminal. The terminal has to have, a use for the gas, or otherwise why build this pipeline? And Jordan Cove really has not obtained, binding contracts to sell their gas if they were to get their permits. So why would you build it? Why would you, have this pipeline? So, the pipeline, I will say this, hats off to landowners that organize and stayed organized. It was really hard in this case to organize landowners, because we're in rural Oregon where a lot of these landowners don't even have computers. And I know some landowners would get their kids to get on my email list so they'd find out what was going on. And it just was hard, and I will say that there's people that actually took the time to mail, mailings constantly out by postal mail just to keep landowners to date of what was going on. Because, Williams, who it was, actually the company that is the owner or whatever of Pacific Connector, and they're 50% owner of the Pacific Connector gas pipeline, and Veresen, the Canadian company that basically has 100% controlling interest in the terminal, is the other 50% owner of the Pacific Connector pipeline. But Williams would have built the pipeline, and they were responsible for the permitting. They were constantly sending out stuff to landowners trying to get them to sign off. And, my hat goes off to landowners for just holding out, because it's pretty scary, I think, to think, people don't want to really go through a legal proceeding where they are going to be eminent domain. That's kind of scary to little rural landowners that don't have the financial backing to fight these big, corporate lawyers. But by sticking together, landowners really, I think that was a key part of this. And you can just see that in the order, how they said, they didn't prove that. Plus that they did a good job, or I think we all did a good job, of explaining the negative impacts that this pipeline alone would have on landowners and on the environment. And, it just does not outweigh anything. They did not prove that their benefit outweighed all that. And because they had so many negative impacts, they had to prove, had to have a higher level of proof that their project was a public benefit.
Now, in what ways would the pipeline have been such a negative? What kind of really negative impacts would it have on the landowners, and why were people so up in arms about it?
Well, I'll just give you an example. The first 2 miles, or the last 2 miles, I guess I should say, of this pipeline, before it reached the substation at the South Dunes Power Plant, goes through 2 miles of the estuary here in Coos Bay. And that is what they call Haynes Inlet. And that estuary, it would have went right through two oyster companies that we have here that sell oysters, and their seed oysters would have been right there, you know, next to where this pipeline was proposed to go up this inlet. You know, their seed oysters are a 3-year supply of oysters. They're highly sensitive to sedimentation in the water. There's a, you know, they were very concerned that they would have, you know, a huge die-off of oysters, and that could have actually cost them their business. It would have negatively impacted them greatly. Not to mention that inlet also is a habitat for salmon, you know, crabs, clams, vital things that are important to other industries in our area, because, you know, the salmon live, you know, and crabs and all those things begin in the estuary. The estuary is where the life, you know, where they get their start. And if you don't have a healthy estuary, you're not going to have healthy industries that are harvesting those marine organisms. So that right there was a negative for a lot of factors. But then the pipeline went on and would have impacted 400 water bodies through southern Oregon. And a lot of those water bodies were salmon-bearing and steelhead-bearing streams. And those, you know, would have taken a negative hit. You're also talking this pipeline, a section of it would have went through timberlands, and you're taking timber out of production. Construction is a 95 or larger clear cut to begin with, and then a minimum.
A 95 what? What size?
95 wide, foot wide. That's like an 8-lane freeway for just the construction. And then in the end, the permanent easement is minimum of 30 feet, and that's in the timberland area. So you're taking timber out of production, and some areas permanently out of production. So you're impacting some of these private, smaller timber operators that were going to be impacted, because most of the pipeline, about 157 miles of it, went through private lands. But still some went through public forest lands, and about 30 miles of it went to forest land. So it still impacted other things too. But, you know, you're impacting businesses. And then there's ranches that were going to be cut right in half. I can think of a rancher who was really upset over in Douglas County. And, you know, he can't build on the pipeline. Goes through your property, you can't do much of anything. If you could graze on it, okay, or you could grow crops on it, but you always have that threat, okay, that if something goes wrong, you know, you're right there.
Well, actually, speaking of something going wrong, I was thinking about in the wake of the Porter Ranch massive methane leak, one of the discussions that started happening is how much gas pipelines leak. Ordinarily, I mean, it's the what happened in Porter Ranch was a bit excessive, but the fact is that I guess across California, there's that amount of methane being leaking all the time from the myriad of leaks along all the pipelines. So, is that another concern that you had about this pipeline that was going to be going through very sensitive areas, that there would also be potential for a lot of methane leaks and possibly explosions?
Well, yes, and you know, we live here right on the Cascadia subduction zone, and they're not saying it's a matter of if, it's when that happens. And there's, you know, you're talking major subsidence here. The pipeline is going through forested areas where it's hard to get to by road as it is. And if we had an earthquake, it's going to be near impossible. And you're talking forest fires could develop out here. Right now we have a hard time. If people that live out in these rural areas, the fire service is limited. It's you know, a lot of times homes don't make it through fires because, as you know, methane leaks and methane can burn. And it doesn't take much. You know, a spark in the air could set it off, and you're talking major forest fire here and any homes that might be out in these rural areas. And some of these homes, this pipeline is going within 100 feet of the home out in the rural area where there's limited fire service. So you can see the concern of landowners with something like this. And then, you know, there's the whole concept, too, of this gas would be coming from fracking. Fracking fields in Canada are in the Midwest. And we fracked gas, they already know. They drill down, they break the shell, and they put all these chemicals in the ground and try to get this methane out. Well, the methane leaks, and it leaks quite a bit, and they already know this is a significant problem. And you've got methane leaking there, then you're putting it in pipelines that leak, then you're at the terminal, and you know you're going to have some leakage there, and you're compressing it. You're using this power plant that they're proposing is a 420-megawatt power plant. And just to give you an example, the main Bonneville line that comes down and feeds this whole southern region is only 300 megawatt, and we only use like 150 to 200 megawatts of that. And they need a 420-megawatt power plant just to liquefy the gas. We are wasting tons of energy just to ship something overseas where they could be going to renewables and they wouldn't even need this gas. The fact is, at this point in time in history, we have the technology that we can switch our systems to renewable systems. It creates far more jobs, and we do not have then methane leaking into the atmosphere, because methane is like 86 times more potent at trapping heat into the atmosphere as CO2 over a 20-year period. So it's a horrible greenhouse gas, and people sometimes don't realize that we're concerned about CO2 levels. Well, methane is not good either, and we need to actually reduce these greenhouse gases. We don't need to add more unnecessary pipelines, unnecessary LNG projects, or any of our fossil fuel projects to actually increase methane and other greenhouse gas impacts into the atmosphere.
Well, you were talking, when we were talking yesterday, you mentioned that a lot of the energy that was put into stopping this pipeline and terminal had to do with safety concerns, even though climate change is a really big concern, too. So I'm wondering how you balance those two issues when you were organizing people.
You know, it's very challenging because in our area, it's mostly conservatives. They don't really believe in climate change, a lot of people. And so you had to balance the, you know, environmental people with the more conservative people that were seeing this as wrong for economic reasons, because when you export gas, the price of that gas is going to go up for Americans, but also the safety issues. Very challenging, but the safety issues are equally as important. The terminal in particular had problems. We had top hazard experts that had looked at the LNG terminal and determined that the safety measures that they incorporated actually increased the risk and that we were more at risk. And you're building a terminal at the end of an airport runway in a tsunami inundation zone right next to a Cascadia subduction zone. You have a lot of, it's just an inappropriate siting location for one of these terminals. And when you look at even the industry guidelines for where to place these terminals, this terminal proposal did not meet most of those guidelines. And then you have these ships, these huge aircraft carrier-sized ships that would be going down a really narrow bay that have this safety bubble that would follow them. And that's because they're so hazardous. You know, you can't have a risk of somebody, you know, ramming the ship or having a problem with the ship, because there's a mile, you know, the ship, if only one-tenth of one tank leaked out into the water, the flammable vapors from that leak could go out 3 miles. And that's basically our whole area here. So you're putting a lot of people at risk with the ship going in and out if there was to be a problem. Even an accident by, you know, normal means, not everything's 100%, but there's just so many issues here. Our bay is so narrow. These ships have a 40-foot draft. Our bay is only dredged to 37 feet, so they would have to come in and out of the bay at high slack tide, and that's the same tides that the fishermen and other users of the bay depend on. So you're tying up this whole 7 miles with just these LNG ships, when and you're putting it negative impact on the other businesses that use our shippers that use the high slack tides too.
So what do you mean by a safety bubble around the ship?
Well, the Coast Guard, if you look at the Coast Guard water suitability assessment that happened, that they issued back, I think it was in 2007, they put a 500-yard safety bubble around these ships when they came in and out. And no one can enter that bubble except with the permission of the Coast Guard.
Now, is the bubble a physical thing? Are there actual boats that are surrounding the circumference of the boat?
You would have Coast Guard boats with guns and stuff, and, you know, it'd be, you know, it's pretty intense. They would not, they would actually have to go through the bay and clear it of people. If there's crabbers out there, they'd have to tell, they'd have to get out of the way. And then the boat would, after the boat came through, you know, in the 500-yard safety, you know, imaginary bubble had passed, then you could go back and, you know, retrieve your crab pots or whatever if you were out in the bay. So you're talking a lot of recreational users that use the bay in certain times of the year quite a bit when crabbing season and fishing season is in. They would be, you know, they would have to exit that area, and that's a negative impact. And, of course, we have in our area, just Coos County, where I live, where this is being proposed, there's over 3,000 jobs that is tied to tourism and recreation industries. So, I mean, you're talking about you're going to negatively impact those jobs. Right where the terminal and power plant are proposed, across basically across the street from them, is a Dunes National Recreation Area. And there's a campground right now that's right across in that area called Boxcar Hill Campground. That would have to be done away with because it would be in a noise sensitive area. So you're talking a real negative impact to the recreation areas down here. And not to mention, a lot of people move here and retire here to get away from stuff like this. So they're not going to want to live here and, you know, have this threat where, you know, why would you come here and retire here? And so a lot of our area's vitality, you know, that depends on, you know, our area being so unique as it is. You can come here and fish and recreate. You can go out to the beaches, and they're pretty much not developed. And you can, you know, we call it our adventure coast. In fact, National Geographic listed Coos Bay as one of the top 50 adventure towns. So it's not like we're, you know, we don't have some unique, awesome things here that are, that other people don't have. And so why would we want to ruin that?
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning about the FERC decision to torpedo the long-proposed and long-fought-against Jordan Cove LNG facility. And my guest is Coos County activist Jody McCaffrey, who's executive director of Citizens Against LNG. Well, in the last few moments that we have today, Jody, I wanted to talk about the kind of lead-up and expectations to the FERC decision on Friday. I was noticing on your website that you listed that there a decision came down from FERC last September with over 100 stipulations that the companies are going to have to meet. So it seems like there was some rumblings ahead of time that FERC might not be so happy with this proposed pipeline and terminal.
Well, yes, you know, that when FERC issued their certificate on the import terminal, they had like 128 conditions of approval. I mean, some of those could be Jordan Cove would probably never have been able to meet them, but it looked like they approved it. You know, if you can meet all these conditions, you can have this, and that's what I assumed they would do again. If you can meet all these conditions, then yeah, you got the certificate. But it looks like they gave it an approval when the company really didn't, you know, get it. So I think that I'm glad that they didn't do that this time, that they said you just didn't meet this criteria. Because that kind of, you know, you're talking, these landowners have been gone through basically hell, you know, not knowing if their property is going to have a pipeline. You can't sell your property. Clausen Oysters have been trying to sell their business. Who wants to buy a business when a pipeline is going to maybe destroy it, you know? So it's quite significant what they've done here.
So now that you've gotten this victory, which I'm sure you must have had a very cheerful weekend celebrating, what's ahead, and how vigilant do you feel like you need to remain?
I think this is not over yet. I mean, I think we have a lot of permits that are still out there that are being processed. I'm not sure how those will pan out. But I also think, you know, we do need jobs here in Coos County. We need to develop our areas properly. We need to try to go and make the switch to renewables. I believe renewables create 3 to 10 times more jobs per dollar invested than fossil dollars invested in fossil industries. I know that's not, the fossil fuel industry doesn't want to hear that, but that's the way, the truth. We've got to do it for our future. I mean, I want my kids and my grandkids to have a world that's not destroyed from our lack of responsibility. So I think we have a responsibility as citizens to do the right thing. And it's not going to be negative, I don't think, for people that look at it economically. The economics are actually better if you do the right thing. So I'm hoping to be in those kind of, I don't know if there have to be fights, but movements to do the right thing.
Well, I guess it was last spring, a lot of LNG advocates gathered in Salem and had a big protest at the state capitol. And I wonder if you think that those kinds of protests have really contributed to the decision that was made on Friday.
I think that they did help send the message out there. You know, if in nothing else, to help encourage the landowners, you're not alone. Don't give in, you know, for nickels to give these, you know, give up your land. So that probably played a key role in that. But I think it also helped send a message to our elected leaders that we don't, you know, we don't want this. We want to go a different energy direction. And the volume of people that showed up there was very impressive. And I think that did make a difference, yes.
Well, I'm finding it kind of ironic in a way that when the first proposed LNG terminal in Astoria was denied and that whole project went away, that Coos Bay, in a lot of people's eyes, was a foregone conclusion. It's going to happen there. There's not enough resistance to it. Nobody's paying attention. And there, people are more concerned about thinking that they're going to get jobs from the terminal as opposed to up in Astoria where they recognized it was a job destroyer. Obviously, from what you've been telling us today, that's a very wrong impression of Coos Bay. Now that you've had this victory, what would you share with people in Astoria who now, turns out, are still fighting a second LNG proposal?
I think just look at what how FERC ruled here and just, you know, hold the line, because I think that proposal is very similar to ours in some of these horrible siting location for being close to an airport and those kind of things. I know they have a pipeline. I'm not sure where that is as far as, I think they actually, that's actually been challenged in the land use and just, you know, hold the line.
Yeah, well, actually, there was one of the big contested things for the first pipeline, for the first LNG proposed to terminal in Astoria, was the pipeline that was actually going to go through the Mount Hood National Forest and skirting the wilderness areas. And it was drawing an awful lot of opposition. And I think that pipeline changed a bit when that terminal went from being an import to an export terminal. But for sure, you can't really build these terminals without pipelines. So how do you help communities up there to see the ways to fight both the pipeline and the terminal?
I think that the landowners along the pipeline, you know, if they will organize and stick together and not let these companies just come in and bulldoze over them, that this decision shows that people power can do it. Because I think a big significant part of this was the landowners stuck together, did not sign those contracts with the companies, held the line, and actually also participated fully in the regulatory process, told FERC why they shouldn't do it, because obviously FERC listed was quite impressive, the reasons why. That's one thing that's the hardest, I think, for people to understand the importance of their participation in these processes. It does make a difference. It did this time. I really think you can just see it made a difference.
Well, it's interesting because everybody I've talked to about these pipelines and terminal projects over the last several years, when they talk about FERC approval, they all assume that FERC was going to be rubber stamping it, that FERC always approves these projects. So what do you think changed this time? And do you think that this the fact that FERC made the surprise decision on Friday about the Coos Bay project will have some resonance about the way it might come down on some of the other projects around the Pacific Northwest?
Well, I think right now the energy market is really in, limbo, because they overbuilt the market, and now they have this glut of product, and they cannot sell it for what it costs to produce it. So in order to justify a pipeline, you've got to justify, normally these companies go with 20-year contracts. Well, now that's kind of in limbo, and there was a ruling recently in the bankruptcy court in Delaware, that has a precedent setting that said if you file bankruptcy, you can get out of these contracts. Well, that means investors are going to be less likely to invest in these pipelines if they can't get their money back or they don't think they're going to get a return on their investment. So I think people are going to tread a little more carefully, and these pipeline companies and these energy companies have to justify their projects more now, because there's been an overbuild. They've overbuilt that market. There's going to be a glut. In fact, in the LNG, they predict a glut, clear into the next decade. And there's still terminals that are under construction that haven't even gotten into the market yet. So, I think it's right now a good time for people to realize they have a good chance if they just, explain in detail the problems with their particular pipeline or their terminal, and hold the line, and actually use this decision by FERC as an example of, you did it over here, we have just as many issues, and you should also deny this project.
Well, Jody, it's really great talking with you, and I'm sure I'd like to congratulate you on all the good work that you did to have a victory this past weekend. So yes. Thanks for joining us.
And thanks to all the people that, the landowners too, and the people that also participated helping me. Thanks to everyone.
And so we'll be in touch. We'll definitely want to continue this story. So we'll be talking to you soon.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
Sure. We've been talking this morning with Jody McCaffrey, who's with Citizens Against LNG in North Bend, Oregon. And you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locustfocus. Next week, I'll be gone, and we'll be rebroadcasting a show we aired last November with Adam Briggle, author of A Field Philosopher's Guide to Fracking. I'll be back in 2 weeks, and we'll be talking then with Elise Higley, who's with our Family Farms Coalition, about the current struggle to ban GMOs in Oregon. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the Neville Brothers. Thanks for listening.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since. Oh, it's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. Oh, it's been a long time coming, but I know say, brother, help me please. But he winds up knocking me. Now I think I'm able
And good morning. You know, it takes all of us to keep KBOO strong. Did you know you can give gifts of stock to KBOO? We're able to quickly turn those donations into support for the important daily work of KBOO. How do you do this? Call 503-231-8032 or email development@kboo.org for information on how to make a stock gift or a gift of appreciated securities. Thank you. And we're coming up on 11 a.m. here on KBOO Portland, and it will be Health Watch. Today, host Ellen Goldsmith interviews naturopathic doctor and licensed acupuncturist Peter Bongiorno about his new book, Put Anxiety Behind You. And at 11:30, the Radio Zine presents highlights from the fourth annual Happening 2016, featuring a six-person panel of veterans of the Portland music industry talking about how to make it in music while based in Portland. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Heathers, the musical, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from March 10th through April 2nd at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. Based on the classic 1989 film, Westerberg High is ruled by a shoulder-padded, scrunchie-wearing junta, Heather, Heather, and Heather, the hottest and cruelest girls in all of Ohio. But misfit Veronica Sawyer rejects their evil regime for a new boyfriend, the dark and sexy stranger JD, who plans to put the Heathers in their place, 6 feet under. Again, that